Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest this evening is Mr. James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James will be speaking to us from his home in Japan. And James is knowledgeable and, you know, articulate on almost any subject we're likely to discuss involving economics or politics. Good evening, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. You flatter me, good sir. How are you, Mr. Alfred Addisk?
I'm good, good, good. I guess, you know, what can I tell you? At my age, it's hard to tell sometimes whether you're doing well or you're not doing well, but I think I'm doing okay. It's actually morning where you are.
It is indeed.
Yeah, it's evening here. What time is it actually where you are?
It is just going on for 11:30 in the morning.
All right, so we're 10 hours difference or thereabouts. Well, did you say 10:30 or 11:30?
11:30.
Yeah, all right. All right, it's 9:30 where I am or 9:25 where I am right now. In any case, there's an article from DC Clothesline. It says, secret meeting in London to end cash. Central banks aim to institute governmental approval for all purchases and sales. We've seen this. We are concerned the government is going to try to implement that cashless society. And I think we talked a little about this last week, but I don't recall if we considered the slipperiness term I'm just using of digital currency. And what I'm trying to say is this. What's crossed my mind is when we have a gold and silver-based monetary system, it takes time and effort to move your gold or silver from one place to another because they are physical materials, right? Even when we move to a paper-based monetary system, it takes time to move that paper around. You can carry it in your wallet, hand it to the clerk or whatever, and the clerk is going to hand it to, they'll take the drawers and collect them and send them up to the accountant and they'll fool around with it. It takes a while before it gets to the bank. But when you're dealing with the digital currency, because it doesn't have a physical reality beyond ones and zeros on some hard drive, it can move around the world at the speed of light. Cross oceans, as soon as you go in to buy a tube of toothpaste at the grocery store, you put that card in there, bang, you give it a swipe, and the transaction is already at your bank account. The inventory has been changed for the grocery store. All sorts of things happen, and almost instantly with that digital currency. Now, what I'm wondering is, if digital currency is that slippery, right, that fast, is it possible for government to create real currency controls over a purely digital system? Or how long would it take for Bill and Hillary, for example, to figure a way to move $1 million from Arkansas to Paris at the speed of light? You see what I'm saying here?
I do, yeah. No, you raise a number of interesting points there, so let me knock off a few of them if I can. The first, regarding the end of cash and the criminalization of cash that we've been discussing here, I would just like to point people to CorbettReport.com to an article that I had up a couple of weeks ago on this topic called The Criminalization of Cash, where one of the Corbett Report subscribers is in the comment section leaving links to all of these various organizations and in news stories talking about the end of cash, cashless paradigm, all of these various organizations and companies and foundations that are moving towards this. So that's an invaluable resource if people want to check that out. But I guess one of the things that this topic raises is the question of what money fundamentally actually is. And I think we have to keep in mind that money is really just a tool. Even a technology, I guess you could say, although technology makes us think of electronic gadgets. But I mean, just in the sense of a tool that helps us to accomplish something. And in this case, it is meant to help us facilitate the exchange of goods from one person to another. So in that sense, the idea of electronic currency and everything being digital, well, that makes it just that much more easy to transfer things around. As you say, we don't have to physically transport gold or paper or anything. We can just use these gadgets to move things around wirelessly and seamlessly. So in a sense, that helps to facilitate those transactions and if all things being equal, hey, that would be a good thing. But of course, not all things are equal. And one of the aspects to this is the psychology behind not actually having a physical object that you were handing over actually makes you more inclined to spend more. And this is, of course, something that's been well understood since at least the time of the introduction of the credit card. And people are happy to swipe that card all day long, even if they don't have money, because they don't feel like they are spending money. If you were physically taking money out of your wallet and handing it over every time you pay for something, you were less likely to pay exorbitant amounts. But if you are just swiping a card, you are more likely to spend money that you don't have. And I think this is something that has been well understood for a long time. So it is in the interests of a consumerist, consumer-driven society that's always trying to find ways to part people with their money to make this money into an extremely easy to spend commodity. And then the other aspect of this that you raise, which I think is exceptionally important, is that, of course, ultimately a cashless society would be in so many ways, it would make it so easy to facilitate laundering of these funds, because although in some sense,
stealing.
Well,
I mean, hackers are grabbing this stuff from.
You're exactly right. Yes. No, you're right.
And how do we have currency controls if kids that are barely out of high school have smart enough to rob millions from people who are on another continent?
Well, let's put this into perspective. I think, like all of these other technological problems, there are a very, very small number of people who actually really know how to hack into these systems and to do those amazing things. And of course, there will be some, you know, young high school geniuses who can do that, but not the majority of them. That's still the purview of a very small number of people. But the point is that those people who really do understand how these systems work and who are generally either the ones devising the systems or being the ones hacking into them from the outside are the ones who will be able to control that. And if they are smart about it and act in a smart cartel fashion about it, they could act behind the scenes without most people really noticing what's going on, without realizing that the entire system is really gamed by the people who kind of have the keys to the vault, if you will. Of course, we're talking virtual keys to a virtual vault, but I think the analogy still holds. And in that regard, of course, it's going to be the well-connected political and financial elite like the Clintons or whoever who will have access to the people who know how to do this and will be able to facilitate these types of transactions, let alone, of course, what's done by the big, you know, the big agencies, the CIA or whoever who needs to facilitate some sort of black op operation. How much easier is it in a world of cashless payments where you don't have to commit some crazy Iran-Contra scheme? You can just cook up some digital ones and zeros and send them wherever you need them to be. So it raises all sorts of issues that the public hasn't thought about very well, but I guarantee you the Rand Corporation and organizations like that have thought about this at great length.
You know, I disagree with you to this extent. I don't think it's going to be that rare for people to understand how to hack in and take money that they haven't earned. And I say that because all of these digital monetary systems depend on not just having ATM machines at every 7-Eleven. They depend on connections that are there at the checkout counter for every store in the country. They depend on having connections where you can do your banking. I can do electronic banking from my home computer. And what I'm trying to say is that when the system is that accessible, 200 million people can access this system here in this country. How do you restrict it to make sure that no crooks are among the 200 million? If you're going to make it sufficiently user-friendly where 200 million can access, I don't think you can maintain a sufficient security to protect, you know, against a fairly widespread problem. But in any case, we'll watch and see.
Let me comment on that, because I think there is an answer to that, and it's very counterintuitive. I understand it's counterintuitive, but it's very interesting that the most effective way to secure an electronic system like that is to make it open. And by that, I mean to make the source code for whatever you're doing an open source source code so that people, anyone can look into it and see what's happening. And that sounds ridiculous because then, of course, then the hackers will have the source code and they'll know exactly what's happening. They'll be able to. But in fact, when you look at the ways that really secure software is designed, it's designed through open source principles so that you have everyone looking at the code, everyone who's able to look at computer code, looking at the code, looking for flaws and exploits in the security systems, and then upgrading them and trying to patch them over. So, of course, you do have the criminals who have access to that as well, but you also have the vast majority of people who are looking to protect their information and protect and make sure it is secure. And that's, of course, it's not a fail-proof system. It's going to, there are going to be flaws and things, and they'll have to be discovered. But the only way to do that is to leave it open for everyone to access. And that, again, I know that sounds counterintuitive, but that's actually the most effective way to design. And that is how all of the most secure systems are designed. I mean, this isn't theoretical. If you look at all of the operating systems that the backbone of the internet and the most stable systems run on, it is open source software. So this really is a design principle that doesn't make a lot of sense until you actually start thinking about it. But yes, you open it up to everyone. And that's the way we secure it.
But nevertheless, everyone, if we see a flaw, there's some people are going to say, I saw a flaw. And they're going to say, well, thank you very much. And we're going to make that correction.
Of course, yes. And that's exactly why it only takes one person to see the flaw and blow the whistle.
I think I can download $20 million to my account in Bali and kick back for the rest of my life. My main point, though, is that because digital is so slippery, because it has no tangible reality, no physical reality, it's going to be hard to control. I don't know that they can make effective currency controls. I know they'll be able to make currency controls that will restrict the activities of the local pizza delivery man and the girl who's working as a secretary for some guy who sells insurance. I get that. But can they stop Bill and Hillary from moving millions around the world without people being aware? And if it were gold, I'd say, yeah, that's possible. If it were even paper, I'd say, yeah, that's possible. Digital, I wonder. I think it's too slick for them. And if I'm right, it raises a real interesting question. We're just talking today with a guy named Rob West, and he was pointing out how he thought the banking system, he'd been in the financial business for decades. And he pointed out that he would not teach people today what he believed to be true, up until a few years ago. He said, this thing has changed. The banking system has changed. I'm wondering, has the banking system changed or has the currency changed? Are we seeing differences between today and what happened in the 1950s? Are those differences because the banking laws are different, or are they different because we are dealing with a digital currency rather than a fiat currency rather than gold and silver? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think there has to be a certain element of both of those, but I think probably the overriding, I don't know, I'm not speaking from experience here, but I would imagine that the overriding change in the last several years has been the real takeover of the economy by the central banks. And of course, they've always been there and they've always been operating, but the way that they are operating right now is really unlike anything we've seen before in the history of humanity. And it really is changing markets completely, utterly. We now have really no way whatsoever to discover what the true value of a market is at this point, given the incredible amount of manipulation we've seen by the central banks over the last several years. And I think that's got to completely fundamentally change the game for investment bankers and bankers generally.
Do you think that manipulation would be possible without a digital currency, or at least a fiat currency and arguably a digital currency?
Yes. Well, yeah. And again,
to the same extent they do it with fiat?
Well, we've had digital currency of one form or another for quite a while now, if you think about it. I mean, checkbook money is, in a sense, not that fundamentally different from the electronic currencies that we're getting now. It's always been just sort of, numbers in a book somewhere. Now they're just numbers in a database somewhere. So I don't know if that's such a fundamental change in terms of the way the banking...
Someone's still got to put that check in the mail It takes a few days to process. That digital currency right now, you know, it's moving basically at the speed of light. And it has no mass. It doesn't get lost in a fire or whatever. It can be instantly erased, but it doesn't catch fire and burn like a dollar bill. You're not going to find any tycoons lighting their cigars with digital dollars, if you see what I'm talking about. We've got it. It's time for us to, a little bit premature here. We're about 45 seconds early, but let's take a break. A couple of commercial announcements. And James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival with my guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. Here's an article from 24H Gold, and it says, China nears global reserve status. There will be a reset of the financial industry. What they're talking about is the world is anticipating a new global reality with huge implications. China's yuan is posed to be recognized as a global reserve currency. How significant is this? And what is, are we going to see, some people think we're going to see an almost instantaneous fall in the value of the fiat dollar. If this reset, is there going to be a, is the yuan going to be recognized as a global reserve currency? And if so, will it have a dramatic effect, or will it be just something that sort of takes effect over a period of at least months and maybe years?
Yes and yes. So will the yuan become a type of reserve currency? Well, in an indirect sense, yes. I think we've talked about this before, but just to make it clear, the International Monetary Fund operates something called special drawing rights, which is a type of currency that is held by central banks as a reserve currency. But it's not a currency in and of itself. All it is it's a claim to one of four different types of currency: dollars, yen, pound sterling, and euros. And that's the basket of currencies that make up the SDR. So if a central bank is holding an SDR, it can claim a certain amount of dollars or a certain amount of yen or a certain amount. So it can convert those SDRs into those currencies. And China is going to, or is angling to, get the yuan included in that basket of currencies so that it would be the dollar, the yen, the euro, the pound, and the yuan, if China has its way. And that will be taking place later this year. The IMF is going to be examining the basket. They do this every 5 years to see if they need to reweight the basket and if they need to include or exclude any currencies from it. So we'll find out later this year. And it's looking more and more like the yuan will be added, if not this time around, at least by the next time around in 2020. So in that indirect sense, then, the Chinese yuan will be a type of reserve currency in that the SDRs will be redeemable in yuan. Will this make a difference? Well, will this happen overnight in a way that completely eclipses the U.S. dollar? Of course not. Of course not. But it will be one step towards further legitimizing this idea of a basket reserve currency rather than a reserve currency that is the single unitary monopolar dollar. It's a move away from that towards this multilateral system where it's more stable because there are, instead of having one leg, this chair has four legs and soon to be five legs. So it's more inherently more stable, or at least that's the idea. Of course, as I think you and I and the listening audience can understand, this is a step towards the creation of regional and even global currency of a sort. Again, not the type of currency that you and I would ever interact with directly in our day-to-day lives, but one that is kind of backing up the system behind the scenes. And that can be very important for a number of reasons. One of the obvious implications of this is that the yuan would become more in demand and more used in international trade. And of course, it would also mean that the AIIB could be supported, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank that China is setting up right now, could be supported directly through yuan rather than through dollars, which it is being capitalized in initially. So we may see that shift away from the dollar. But again, it will take years, I think, for it to happen. And it's a general waning of the dollar that has been going on for a number of years now and will likely continue for the foreseeable future.
Is China the big winner if China joins this group of four currencies, becomes the fifth that are considered part of the special drawing rights? Does China need to be validated by the IMF? Or does the IMF need to bring China in? Because if they don't, the four remaining currencies may wither without China giving them more strength, more credibility. You see, do you follow what I'm saying?
Glass
half empty or half full?
Right. Well, which glass? I think no matter which way you slice it, humanity is generally the losers in this. But yes, I see your point. And I think it is ultimately a question more of the IMF gaining in importance and gaining in stature and gaining in credibility, rather than it is that China necessarily needs this to take place. And I think it could be a mutual beneficial relationship for them, especially because there have been some reforms on the IMF agenda for a number of years now that have been being stalled by Washington specifically. Washington has been dragging its feet on these IMF reforms that would give China a bigger seat at the IMF table. And this after the fact that during the euro crisis a few years ago, when Christine Lagarde went on her little fundraising tour trying to raise money, I believe China stepped up to the plate with some ridiculous amount of money, $50 billion or something, for the emergency bailout fund. And the understanding really was that this was going to help expedite those IMF reforms. And that hasn't happened so far. So one would imagine that if China is added to the SDR basket, they would have a more pull within that organization, which has been, since its inception, has been quite explicitly a Washington consensus organization. And of course, America has always picked the president of the World Bank, and Europe has always picked the director of the IMF. And we may see in the future, if China is sort of included and folded into this basket and brought into the fold, they may get a bigger seat at the table. They may even be able to appoint a director now and then or something along those lines, which would give sort of more credibility to the IMF in an age where the US and the West is declining in economic importance and the East is rising, or at least that's the script that we're being handed right now.
I've seen reports that China, their official story is that they have a little over 1,000 tons of gold. A lot of people seem to think they've got at least 10,000 tons of gold. Some people think they may have 30,000 tons of gold. One of the things, everybody understands that China's got a lot of gold, although we don't know what the number is. We know they've got a bunch of gold. Why do they have it? What do they expect to gain? They didn't buy that just for ballast in their boat. What did they expect to gain with that gold?
What did they expect to gain, or what did they hope to stop from losing? Might be the other way to put it.
Isn't that pretty? It's yellow and it's shiny and kind of heavy. I think I'll collect some. I have to believe that they are using gold as a tool, as a lever. They are saying, you know, Archimedes, give me a lever long enough and a place to stand. The Chinese are saying, give me a stack of gold high enough, and I can move the world. Or at least, I suspect that's their intent. They have to have a reason to acquire all of that gold. What is their reason?
Well, I think that we have to understand that because of China's trade surplus over the years, they've accumulated an incredible amount of money in reserves. And we all know that they bought up $1 trillion of U.S. treasuries over that time and have stopped doing so. They still have a trade surplus. They still have money that they are gaining from all of this trade that they have to do something with. And they can't just bring it back into the country because, of course, that would flood their own domestic markets and create havoc for in terms of inflation of the yuan. So what do you do with those reserves? And I think there are a few different answers to this that China is trying to use right now. I mean, one is that you can just continue buying U.S. debt and supporting the U.S. government till the cows come home. But perhaps more strategically, you can do things like starting an infrastructure investment bank where you take some of these tens of billions of dollars and instead of just parking them in a bank somewhere, parking them in treasuries, you start using them, spending them into the economies of your neighbors to build up the infrastructure there so that you have other trading partners to go to rather than simply the U.S. You can also, of course, put it in gold. If you are concerned about the U.S. dollar itself and the stability of that system, or potentially if you have, say, $1 trillion worth of debt holdings of a country that you were planning to dump somewhere along the road, you can't just dump them. You can't do that unless you are willing to take not only a $1 trillion hit to yourself and the loss of your biggest trading partner, but the disruption of the global economy generally, and what would undoubtedly be an inferno that would burn up every fiat currency on the planet. Unless you have something backing that up in the background, not necessarily explicitly tied to the value of your currency, but something that you could trot out when and if needed to say, hey, look, we have 20,000 tons or whatever you need to say at that time to stabilize your economy. So there's a lot of different reasons. Again, it's speculation from the outside, but there's no happy reason for this, that there's going to be some, you know, wonderful thing. It's only to prevent disaster and or to bring that disaster about as a type of secret weapon.
You recently interviewed Michael Chesedovsky on global warfare and the New World Order. Now, I haven't heard that interview, but I am interested in what you learned or what kind of opinions you came to. Do we need nuclear weapons to fight a global war in the New World Order, or can we get it done by just attacking somebody's currencies or their computer systems, their monetary system, their digital currencies? What do we have to do? Do we need nuclear weapons, or can we get this done more in a more sophisticated manner by a couple of keystrokes?
Well, that is really an important question, and one that I hope people will check into an interview or a roundtable discussion I had about a year ago on World War III cometh. And basically, in that discussion, myself and Guillermo Jimenez and Pierce Redmond were discussing this topic of World War III and what it might look like if and when it eventuates, and how in World War I, basically, everyone was trying to fight the wars of the 19th century before they realized, oh, we're in the 20th century now, and the technology is completely different. It's a completely different ball game. In World War II, they were trying to prepare for World War I trench warfare, and suddenly that didn't work at all, and they had to completely revise what they were thinking. And one would imagine World War III will be the same. And in this case, it may not even be the type of military carnage that we saw in those wars. It could be something completely different, like economic warfare and cyber warfare. There are many different ways to wage warfare these days that are technologically enabled that don't really look like warfare as we've known it before. So I think that's an important point to bring up. Is nuclear warfare necessary in terms of waging global warfare? It certainly isn't. But the interesting part is that since at least 2002, I believe it was, the United States official nuclear policy is that they reserve first strike nuclear strikes with tactical nuclear weapons. So they've baked this into the cake for at least 15 years now in terms of policy documents, strategy documents that are on record saying that they reserve the right to begin a nuclear war, basically, with these tactical nukes, these so-called mini nukes that aren't as big as the big, 100 megaton giant bombs. These are just tiny little bombs.
If it only knocks down half a city, it doesn't really count as a nuclear attack. Got to knock out the whole city.
Exactly.
That's nuclear. Yeah. I'm wondering whether we're not already in that World War III. Do you think we are? I mean,
Yeah, well,
we can fight that war in ways that are no longer violent.
Right.
It may be that you're talking about fighting the World War II. We fought it the way we think we should have fought World War I and so on. Do we need aircraft carriers? You know, or are they foolish? Can things be accomplished while we're building aircraft carriers? Is somebody just working on a better virus, computer virus?
Or real virus, even. Race-specific bioweapons has been proposed by the Project for a New American Century with Dick Cheney et al. Back in the early 2000s, shortly before 9/11. So that's something that's been talked about for decades. Yes, I think that the measurement of militaries in terms of number of troops or number of aircraft carriers or number of missiles or that type of thing is outdated and reflects outdated thinking. And I think that would become very apparent if and when we got into a hot war scenario with some of the world's military superpowers, when some of the things that have been worked on behind the scenes that the public hasn't been exposed to yet will suddenly be unveiled to the public, whatever they may be, whether they're weather manipulation technologies or electromagnetic types of weapons or things of that nature that just completely beggar our imagination. I mean, let's remember World War II ended with the dropping of the atom bomb, something that wasn't even conceivable by the majority of the public before that war started, and then suddenly it was just a fait accompli at the end of the war. I think we'll see something similar if and when we get into that hot war scenario. I guess World War III, is it here? Are we in it? That can be a question of semantics, but I think when the real, true, hot global war starts, if and when it does, I don't think we'll be asking that question. I think it will be quite apparent.
I agree with it'll probably be. I'm inclined to agree with you, but we are in a gray area right now where you could be at war and it might not be abundantly clear that there's a real war going on. We used to talk about the Cold War. Now we are perhaps in the digital war. And it's not anywhere near as apparent as hot war, and maybe not even as apparent as Cold War. I mean, the Stuxnet virus that attacked, Iranian nuclear facilities, if I recall correctly. There's war going on here in strange ways. And we live in an increasingly unusual and interesting world. I want to thank you for being on the program. As always, James, this is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. I'm Alfred Adisk. This is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.